died as of August 26th, 229 more deaths reported than the day before, and 1,246 more than a week ago. West Texas Intermediate crude is trading at $42.56, down 83 cents. Before we go to coronavirus briefs, I'll read this set of numbers. These are the unemployment numbers. For Texas, almost 3.3 million Texans have filed for unemployment relief since mid-March. Texas's unemployment rate was 8% in July. That was up from 3.5% in July 2019. In July, Texas's sales tax revenues were up 4.3% from July 2019. Now here's a look at our latest numbers released today nationally. Another 1 million American workers filed for first-time unemployment benefits last week on a seasonally adjusted basis, the Labor Department reported Thursday. The report met economists' expectations, but it's still a disappointment. So far, we've only seen 1 week at the start of August with fewer than 1 million claims since March, when the pandemic started to take a toll on America's job market. Continued jobless claims, which count people filing at least 2 weeks in a row, stood at 14.5 million. These estimates do not include claims under the government's pandemic aid programs, which are in part designed to help those who cannot otherwise access regular unemployment benefits. Now here are today's coronavirus briefs. Global COVID-19 cases have surpassed 24 million, according to Johns Hopkins University. A $5 coronavirus test that could deliver results within 15 minutes has received emergency use authorization from the Food and Drug Administration. The Justice Department requested data on the coronavirus in nursing homes from the Democratic governors of four states, while claiming that their choices during the pandemic may have resulted in the deaths of thousands of elderly nursing home residents, a move some saw as politically motivated. Now, here are some short articles. Texas governor explains how the state is handling a second hurricane during the pandemic. Texas has dealt with two hurricanes during the global COVID-19 pandemic, Governor Greg Abbott told CNN's Allison Camerota on Thursday morning. After Hurricane Hanna hit the Corpus Christi area in July, the state learned new strategies, he said. He said ahead of Hurricane Laura, as opposed to evacuating people to large convention centers and things like that, we've tried to put as many as possible in hotel rooms so that families can isolate together, so that they are not in a congregate setting spreading COVID-19. We're hoping everybody here continues to follow the same standards of wearing a mask, sanitizing your hands, as well as maintaining your distance. If they were able to do that, I have no doubt that we will be able to continue to contain COVID-19, he said. U.S. federal agency invests in needle-free vaccine technologies. The U.S. federal government said Wednesday it's investing nearly $2.5 million in efforts to create a needle-free coronavirus vaccine. The Biomedical Advanced Research and Development Authority, BARDA, announced four small grants to groups trying to make either oral vaccines against coronavirus or patches that could painlessly deliver a vaccine. The novel routes of administration they are developing could reduce the dependence on needles and syringes that are used to deliver vaccine via intramuscular injection. Instead, a wearable skin patch or oral option for vaccines may support rapid large-scale immunization while reducing the strain on the manufacturing supply chain, BARDA said in a statement. The four new technologies are also shelf-stable. Unlike current coronavirus vaccine candidates, they don't have to be kept under special conditions or temperatures, making them easier to store and deliver. CDC director says new testing guidance reflects updated recommendations from the White House. The U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, CDC, made controversial changes to its testing guidelines after updated recommendations from the White House Coronavirus Task Force, CDC Director Dr. Robert Redfield said Wednesday. These updated guidelines, coordinated in conjunction with the White House Coronavirus Task Force, received appropriate attention, consultation, and input from task force experts, Redfield said in a statement to CNN. We are placing an emphasis on testing individuals with symptomatic illness, individuals with a significant exposure, vulnerable populations, including nursing homes or long-term care facilities, critical infrastructure workers, healthcare workers, and first responders, or those individuals who may be asymptomatic when prioritized by medical and public health officials. The changed guidelines. The Trump administration has scrambled to explain the quiet changes made to the CDC website Monday. The previous guidelines recommended testing anyone who had been in close contact with a confirmed case, even people who do not develop symptoms. The new guidelines said only some people should get tested. Controversy over official approval. Earlier, Admiral Brett Grewer, who heads testing efforts for the task force, told reporters that task force members had weighed in on the change, including Redfield and Dr. Anthony Fauci, the nation's top infectious disease expert. But Fauci later denied this to CNN's Dr. Sanjay Gupta. At least three high-profile Democratic governors said their states would not follow new controversial testing guidance by the CDC. The guidelines no longer say that every close contact who has been exposed to the novel coronavirus should get tested. Many in the medical community worry the change could heighten public confusion and hasten the virus's spread. The pandemic is making U.S. drug shortages even worse, FDA says. The coronavirus pandemic is worsening the United States drug shortage problem, according to the Food and Drug Administration. Due to COVID-19, we've had the increasing demand for certain medications, and then we've also had an increase in hospitalizations, which has drained the supply. Patients wanting to stock up, and that's a normal reaction. That's been another reason. Valerie Jensen, Associate Director of the Drug Shortages Staff at the FDA, said Wednesday on the podcast FDA Insight. And then, sometimes we've had some cases of slower manufacturing times due to labor shortages in some of the areas that have been harder hit. Traditionally, Jensen said drug shortages are rooted in manufacturing and quality problems involving sterile injectable drugs, especially older ones. Those are the very kinds of medications used by hospitalized patients that are facing shortages and increased demand. There are also shortages of pharmacy drugs, like those for high blood pressure and antibiotics. Jensen said the FDA has been in contact with more than 180 drug manufacturers since January, working to stabilize supply chains and monitor potential disruptions. Now from the Associated Press. Nursing homes juggle hurricane evacuations amid virus fears. Dozens of nursing homes evacuated their residents as Hurricane Laura bore down Wednesday, but many others, with a choice, just stayed put, concluding the risk of breaking their coronavirus lockdowns could be more deadly than the storm. It is always best if you can remain in an environment that is familiar, said Charles Solomon, who runs The Resort at Texas City, a nursing home with 79 residents near the Galveston Bay shoreline. The facility suffered a COVID-19 outbreak that infected 55 residents, killing 17, but now is free of the cases. Because it is outside of the evacuation zone and has never flooded in the past, the staff decided it would be best to stay in place, particularly given fears of reintroducing the virus. Since we are a COVID-free facility, it would be best to remain that way, Solomon said. Shifting storm tracks and the trauma of transferring vulnerable residents can make the calculus of whether to stay or to go difficult for nursing home operators. The added risk of virus exposure convinced some homes that they're better off braving the storm in place. Others, those under mandatory evacuation orders, have scrambled to move residents inland as Laura nears. The Texas Health and Human Services Commission said 64 long-term care facilities housing about 1,500 residents had evacuated as of Wednesday afternoon. In Louisiana, more than 800 residents in 11 nursing homes were also evacuated, according to the state health department. Now here's an article from the Austin American-Statesman. Texas seeing fewer COVID-19 patients, but hospitalizations far higher than April and May. While backlogged cases and reporting glitches have clouded the picture of the coronavirus outbreak in Texas, one thing remains clear. The number of people being treated for COVID-19 in Texas hospitals continues to decline. The Texas Department of State Health Services reported 4,907 coronavirus patients in hospitals statewide Tuesday, the first time since June that the number has dipped below 5,000. The hospitalization figure generally has been dropping since it hit 10,893 on July 22nd, even as daily reported fatality numbers remain at high levels. On Wednesday, state health officials reported an additional 229 deaths for a total of 11,805. The drop in hospitalizations is a promising sign for Texas, one that Governor Greg Abbott has said indicates that his statewide mask order is working and coronavirus treatments are improving. In a pair of news conferences earlier this month, Abbott said although the numbers of COVID-19 hospitalizations are declining, the figure remains too high for the state's healthcare system. Even as the number of COVID-19 patients has continued to decline since his remarks, the figure is more than double the number of people hospitalized through April and May. During those 2 months, coronavirus hospitalizations hovered below 2,000 patients. The figure soared in June after Abbott's swift reopening of restaurants, bars, retail stores, malls, hair salons, and movie theaters in May. Abbott has stressed that hospitalizations must continue to decrease and the percentage of people testing positive among those being tested must drop below 10% for a sustained period before he would move to resume reopening plans. He has not given a hospitalization benchmark, however, that would allow a broader reopening of the Texas economy. An Abbott spokesman did not respond to requests for comment. Chris Van Dusen, a Texas Department of State Health Services spokesman, said the declining number of new cases and hospitalizations has helped ease the burden on hospitals, but Texans should continue to follow social distancing guidelines to keep the trend moving in the right direction. New cases and hospitalizations are still higher than they were in May and early June, so if there is any reversal, we could easily end up in a situation where the healthcare system is again strained, he said Wednesday. Elective surgeries. An elective surgery ban remains in place for certain parts of the state, including Central Texas, where declining hospitalizations and cases led Austin health officials on Tuesday to recommend a drop to Stage 3 coronavirus restrictions for the first time since June. Stage 3 guidelines expand the limit for safe gatherings to no more than 10 people. Stage 3 also removes the recommendation for those at low risk to avoid non-essential travel, shopping, and dining. Hotspots. Van Dusen said the Department of State Health Services continues to watch hospitalizations and capacity across the state, including in Laredo, Corpus Christi, and other areas that became coronavirus hotspots last month. The state health agency reported 101 intensive care unit beds available in the Rio Grande Valley, a significant improvement since July, when the area saw available ICU beds drop into the single digits. However, new modeling from the University of Texas shows that the area is still vulnerable, ranking counties across the country based on risk of infections and deaths. Researchers found that many South Texas counties remain among the most vulnerable in the state for COVID-19 fatalities. The modeling uses several indicators to determine vulnerability, including ICU availability, the percentage of population in poor health, the percentage of residents with limited English ability, and the percentage of people without medical insurance. Now, here's another article from CNN. The pandemic threatens how we naturally grow and benefit from relationships. by Kristen Rogers. In an era of hypervigilance during a pandemic, whether some of our relationships will survive is up in the air. Our brains have established methods for recognizing people as close friends or acquaintances, and the closest ties are built on a substantial investment of time and trust, both of which may be challenged by the current pandemic, said Andrea Courtney, a postdoctoral research fellow in psychology at Stanford University in California, who wasn't involved in a newly released review on social bonds. How humans develop and maintain relationships with friends and family is similar to the behaviors of societies in our evolutionary history and those of other primates, according to the review published Tuesday in the journal Proceedings of the Royal Society A, Mathematical and Physical Sciences. Although many of us live in cities, along with millions of other people, our personal social worlds contain anywhere from 78 to 250 people, with an average of about 154 individuals. That means that most people interact with a small number of other people, and those people remain relatively stable over time, according to review author Robin Dunbar, a professor emeritus of evolutionary psychology in the Department of Experimental Psychology at the University of Oxford in England. These people are organized into layers within social networks, and those layers are dependent on cognitive, emotional, and time constraints on our capacities for interaction. The organization of our cognitive social networks. Why can most humans handle only about 154 people? That value as a natural group size relates to the size of the brain's neocortex, which is involved in sensory perception, motor commands, spatial reasoning, language, and conscious thought. Having robust personal social networks is positively correlated with brain size and capacity for mental functions that help to assess other people. These networks consist of layers in accordance with relationships of varying quality. People considered to be intimates, family, and close friends are close in proximity and small in number. Types of friends and acquaintances extend further away from someone and grow in numbers. How humans and animals bond. The bonding process in both primates and humans is complex and time-consuming, the review said. When animals are faced with the issue of maintaining group stability amid stresses, the solution is bonded relationships, which help ensure that members will behave similarly to one another and stay together. Primates accomplish this bonding by social grooming, an activity that is time-consuming, but can also create a sense of reciprocity, obligation, and trust. Whether we humans trust someone is partly determined by the time we can spend with that person. Human social networks reflect how we invest our time in certain people, which also determines the quality of those relationships. The human bonding process involves two factors that work together: how the human version of social grooming activates endorphins, and how our social brain uses interpersonal closeness. When our brains activate and use up endorphins stimulated by human touch, we can experience an opioid-like sense of relaxation, contentment, and warmth that seems to provide bondedness, the review said. That bondedness leads to a mental sense of trust and obligation to help one another. But the intimacy and demand on time limit the number of relationships one can bond with using touch. Endorphins are fleeting, so their need for constant activation to maintain bonding levels make bonding time consuming. Laughing, singing, dancing, storytelling, eating, and drinking are activities, when done with others, can trigger the endorphin system in a way that is time efficient and grooming at a distance, the review said. Virtual activities slow down the rate of decay on relationships, but they won't stop them from dying eventually, Dunbar said in an email. Face-to-face is necessary for that, it seems. There is something very special about being able to see the whites of their eyes across the table, to reach out and touch them, that no digital media can yet match. Seven pillars of friendship. Our knowledge of other people, which is built up by being in close contact, helps us bond and increase trust that others will meet our needs. Sharing common cultural dimensions known as the seven pillars of friendship, language or dialect, place of origin, educational path, hobbies and interests, worldview, musical tastes, and sense of humor, can influence the strength and altruism of relationships, according to a prior analysis by Dunbar. The pillars identify what community you belong to, and the community whose mores and behavior you understand in a very intuitive way, Dunbar said in the review. These commonalities enable relationships to flow, since both parties would better understand each other, share similar interests, and have a sense of how much they can trust one another. Emotional and physical closeness. At the core of human and primate friendships are being close in terms of spatial proximity and feeling close by emotional proximity, influenced by time spent together. These ensure that bonded individuals stay together so that they are on hand when support is needed, Dunbar said in the review. To hold someone in your close friends layer, you need to see them at least once a week. The best friends layer, at least once a month. And the friends layer, at least once a year, Dunbar said. Drop below those rates and the person will slip into the layer below within a few months, he added. This is because the time you invest in direct interaction with someone determines the sense of emotional closeness you have with them, and the sense that this is mutual. The social and health consequences of personal ties. Trust and time available are crucial to social networks. When those are threatened by internal stressors or external threats, like a pandemic, relationships are at risk for declines in emotional strength, major upheavals, or ultimately breaking down. Because of the greater likelihood of forgiveness and inherent bond, family members have appeared to bounce back from the lack of opportunities to interact, Dunbar said. Friendships require more investment for constant connection and are more likely to fade when under threat. Social breakdowns could have ill effects for our health, well-being, and longevity, the review said. The number and quality of close friendships a person has can affect his or her happiness and capacity to recover from illness. Smaller social networks are associated with greater feelings of isolation and loneliness, which can affect rates of disease and death. In light of the social distancing, quarantining, and lockdowns imposed by COVID-19, Dunbar anticipated a few likely effects. A weakening of friendships that could make for awkward reunions, an increased effort to contact old friends after lockdowns, and fear of contracting the virus to reduce how often some people, introverts and the psychologically more cautious, visit places where they could encounter people they don't know. The inability to assess these behaviors and infection risk of low-ranked friends and distant family members could result in smaller, more inverted social networks, Dunbar predicted. Network patterns may return to normal within a year, but some friendship ties may be weakened enough to become acquaintances, the review said. Focusing more time on close relationships may boost well-being in the short term, Courtney said in an email. In fact, recent research has observed a decrease in loneliness following the pandemic. This may reflect the fact that many people are now clinging to their closest ties. Although physical contact is now much more limited, many of these other virtual bonding opportunities are just as abundant as ever. To keep up relationships, emotional closeness, and trust during this time, stay in virtual touch as much as possible, Dunbar suggested. And remind your loved ones, I'm still here and thinking about you. Now here's an article from Time Magazine. one note before I begin this article. It was written earlier in the pandemic. Contagion of fear, 1 month inside a New York hospital as a virus took over the world, by Simon Schuster. On March 14th, New York City announced its first death from COVID-19. It quickly became the epicenter of the global pandemic. One overburdened hospital at the heart of the outbreak struggled to save lives as terrified staff fell ill or refused to come to work. As the pandemic rages elsewhere, its story shows what lies ahead for cities, states, and hospitals in its deadly path. Dr. Parvez Mir was already in bed on the night of March 4th, about to fall asleep, when his colleagues called to break the news. In room 10 of the intensive care unit that Mir has led for more than two decades, they were looking at their first case of COVID-19, an elderly woman, feverish and frail, who had arrived by ambulance with pneumonia in both lungs. In 10 days, she would be the first patient to die of this disease in New York, the first of more than 30,400 in this one state. Until her diagnosis, the new coronavirus had seemed like an abstract threat to Mir and his staff at Wyckoff Heights Medical Center in Brooklyn. All they knew in early March was what the news had reported. An outbreak in China had spread across Asia and jumped to Europe, killing thousands. Like most U.S. hospitals, Wyckoff had done practically nothing to prepare. Its intensive care unit had only one room equipped to handle patients with a highly infectious disease. Within a month, it had built out 60 of them around the hospital. "Now everything that walks into the emergency room is COVID," Mir tells me on a tour of his ward on April 22nd, his face protected by a shield fashioned from a welder's mask. In the rooms around us, a dozen patients cling to life on ventilators, their beds cocooned in plastic sheets that are stapled to the ceiling and duct-taped to the walls. From overhead, the loudspeaker issues a call for help. "Respiratory and anesthesia, stat." That has become the refrain of this pandemic. Mir has heard it hundreds of times. Wyckoff, with a capacity of around 350 beds, has treated more than 2,000 COVID-19 patients, the vast majority of them Latino and Black, with poor health insurance or none at all. Almost 300 died. Nearly 200 Wyckoff workers became infected. Others could not handle their fear of infection and stopped coming to work. "I don't think we'll ever be the same," Mir says once the loudspeaker goes quiet, leaving only the hisses and beeps of the breathing machines. "We've seen so much death, so much chaos, so much catastrophe." The disease has now killed more than 111,000 in the U.S. and 407,000 worldwide. New hotspots are erupting from North Carolina to Arizona as states reopen, driven by public and political pressure to revive the economy, even as medical experts warn that a second wave of the disease is all but inevitable. Many countries have yet to reach their peak of infections. Starting on April 9th, as the pandemic reached its apex in New York City, Wyckoff granted reporters from Time access to its facilities and staff. "Our goal was to gather the fullest possible account of how the outbreak played out within its walls, from its emergency room and makeshift morgues to the minds of the people who work there." This much is clear. As more states confront COVID-19 outbreaks, the experiences of Wyckoff suggest there is little that can prepare hospital staff for what they will face. Mir and his colleagues were forced to improvise, troubleshooting remedies for a disease that no one understood. Alongside the medical challenge, Wyckoff battled a simultaneous contagion, an outbreak of fear that nearly crippled the hospital at its time of greatest need. Shortages of masks and disinfectant fueled that anxiety. But underneath, it was the human instinct of survival, which the hospital workers still struggle to suppress. Countless time each day, they've had to ask themselves, "Will this be the patient that gets me sick?" Will this be the day I infect my family? That terror swept through Wyckoff more quickly than the virus. Dozens of its healthcare workers, cleaners, and technical staff walked off the job, took leave, or retired. And by the height of the pandemic, the hospital was operating without one in every four employees. The most routine chores, like disinfecting rooms or checking vital signs, still need to be weighed against the chance of infection. That pressure has had a strange effect, says Dr. Lisandro Irizarry, the head of Wyckoff's emergency department. It strained the natural instinct of a medical worker to surround a patient with care. When this all first started, he tells me, the patient was the pariah. The diagnosis of Wyckoff's first coronavirus case started as a hunch. Under the guidelines issued in February by the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services, Mir should not have had reason to worry about her. She hadn't traveled recently to any country with a major outbreak. She hadn't been in contact with any confirmed carriers of the disease. The U.S. medical establishment had not yet grasped how quickly the virus was spreading within American communities. Neither had the U.S. president. "We're doing a great job with it," Donald Trump said on March 10th, almost a week after Wyckoff's first coronavirus patient tested positive. "And it will go away. Just stay calm. It will go away." Mir was not so sure. His patient's symptoms resembled what doctors in Asia and Europe had been reporting. To play it safe, he put the 82-year-old woman in isolation the day after she arrived at the hospital. She showed signs of recovery after a week on the ventilator. But after 10 days in the hospital, she died. A bank of news cameras gathered outside of Wyckoff the next day. To hear of the death, the first New Yorker to die related to coronavirus, this is a very painful moment, Mayor Bill de Blasio said in announcing the news at a press conference. For Wyckoff, it wasn't just painful, but terrifying. 28 staff members had been exposed to the patient. None had worn masks or goggles, because government guidelines were not yet urging them to do so. Now, all of them, including several nurses, three paramedics, and one of the hospital's two lung care specialists, had to begin 2 weeks of quarantine. Mir, who had not been exposed to the patient, was left to lead the intensive care ward on his own. He suspected that the staff under quarantine might soon start showing symptoms, but he did not expect one of the first to be the nurse he calls "My Amy." That's Amy O'Sullivan, the straight-talking, fist-pumping force of the emergency room, who was known to hit the gym after a 12-hour shift and then drive her Wrangler to the Jersey Shore on weekends to go surfing with her wife and three daughters. The oxygen levels in O'Sullivan's blood were so low by the time she got tested in early March that colleagues wondered how she was conscious. Mir moved her to an isolation room on the 10th floor, room 11, next door to where the 82-year-old woman was clinging to life. He asked O'Sullivan if she could breathe without a ventilator. She shook her head no. Through the window of her isolation room, she could see a few of her fellow nurses crying. One of the last things, Mir recalls O'Sullivan saying before she went unconscious, was, "Please save me so I can get back to work." Mir took over the intensive care unit at Wyckoff, a 16-bed facility within the hospital, in 1998, and he's been here ever since. From the ward's 10th floor windows, he can look across the East River to Manhattan, to wealthy neighborhoods with some of the city's lowest COVID-19 death rates. Brooklyn and Queens, by comparison, each have had more than 5,000 deaths, more than any other areas in the country by far. The reason is tied to demographics. The area around Wyckoff is predominantly poor, black, and brown, with multiple families living in cramped apartments. About 30% of the population in the Wyckoff zip code live below the poverty line. "It went through like a blitzkrieg," said Ramon Rodriguez, the hospital's president and CEO. It's almost as if we're washing away a whole generation of Black and Latino people. Incomes here are too low and health insurance too rare to sustain enough private doctors to serve the population. The result is what's known as a primary care desert, with Wyckoff the only source of health care for much of the community. Its emergency room typically treats everything from rashes to upset stomachs, conditions that patients in more affluent neighborhoods might take to their family doctors. But these visitors disappeared when the pandemic started, as people, afraid of infection, stayed away. New intensive care units were set up on several floors of the hospital. The pediatric emergency area was converted into an adult ICU. Nurses from across the hospital were reassigned to work in it, even if they had never managed a ventilator or dealt with infectious diseases. Many refused. The biggest problem at Wyckoff was not a shortage of ventilators or protective masks. The biggest problem we had was staffing, said Rodriguez. We were running people ragged. I was starting to see people break. Out of roughly 1,800 full-time employees, a quarter stopped coming to work at some point during the pandemic, virtually all because of illness or fear of infection. Tamikia Malong, an intensive care nurse, took leave the day after Wyckoff diagnosed its first patient with COVID-19. She was 6 months pregnant and terrified of losing her baby. Even though she never came into contact with the coronavirus patient, Malong contracted the disease and believes she infected her sister, mother, and grandmother, who had to be hospitalized. All of them recovered, but Malong refuses to go back to work. Psychologically, physically, I just can't, says Malong, who is due to give birth this month. Between late May and early April, the nursing department saw 50 people calling in sick every day. They were panicking, says the department head, Catherine Gallagher-Simon. Each morning, she would assign nurses to shifts treating COVID-19 patients. With some of the less experienced ones, she says, it felt like throwing them to the wolves. Some hospital staff took their concerns about infection to their union delegate, Jacqueline Venner, who fought with the administration about overtime and hazard pay. It was also Venner who scolded people for skirting their work out of fear, always adding her catchphrase, "You got this." But she sympathized with some who stayed away. Many nurses were close to retirement, had spouses at home with health problems, or both. They had paid their dues and were not willing to risk a deadly infection at the end of their long careers. Others had weakened immune systems. One was trying to get pregnant with the help of IVF, and her doctors would not harvest her eggs if she was exposed to COVID-19. Even for young and healthy nurses, the demands of an already difficult job became brutal. Shifts ran for well over 12 hours, often with triple the usual number of patients to manage. In the last week of March, the hospital began to run out of disinfectants, and nurses brought bleach from home to wipe down beds in the emergency room. Asta Moorhead, the head of the department responsible for keeping Wyckoff clean, took a woman on her staff to disinfect the room of a COVID-19 patient. The woman had suited up to protect herself, but in the doorway, she froze, turned around, and ran. When I found her later, she was a mess, Moorhead recalls. She was crying and saying she didn't want to die. She didn't want her kids to get sick. At the end of every shift, staff risked taking the virus home on their clothes, in their hair, on the bottoms of their shoes. Their anxiety spread to their families, sometimes causing rifts between workers and their loved ones. You're here caring for people, saving lives, says Izari. Then you go home and your family members look at you as though you represent a threat to them. One nurse's husband died of COVID-19. Another discovered that both her children were infected. Jamwanti Persaud, the patient care manager in the emergency room, watched her father-in-law deteriorate, gasping for breath, until he died in early April. She lay awake and wondered, did I bring it home? Hospital staffing problems were so acute in New York by the end of March that Governor Andrew Cuomo issued a plea to the rest of the nation. If you don't have a health care crisis in your community, please come help us in New York now, Cuomo said at a press conference as the state's death toll surpassed 1,000. Today it's New York. Tomorrow it will be somewhere else. A few days later, New Yorkers' cell phones squealed with an emergency alert calling on all healthcare workers to come work at understaffed hospitals. It was the citywide equivalent of someone shouting, "Is there a doctor in the house?" The most common approach in these situations is redeployment, ordering medical professionals from around the campus to put their usual jobs on hold and focus on the current crisis. That did not work in New York, in part because people resisted their reassignments. Some outside help arrived in April when the USNS Comfort docked in New York City and began taking COVID-19 patients, about 50 from Wyckoff by the end of the month. Mir also did some recruiting. Through a staffing agency, he found a pulmonologist in Arkansas, Dr. Rebecca Martin, who flew to New York and spent a 96-hour work week at Wyckoff. The scene was beyond her worst expectations. Patients were packed so tightly in the emergency room that it was hard to pass between gurneys. The supply of sedatives ran so short that patients would sometimes wake up prematurely and pull their breathing tubes out of their throats. The good news was that the hospital had enough ventilators. The bad news was the shortage of staff who knew how to work them. Usually, the news sensationalizes things, says Martin. Here, the reality was 100 times worse than what the news was showing. Martin wondered how many colleagues at her own hospital, Baxter Regional Medical Center in northern Arkansas, would stick around to fight COVID-19 if it arrived. Some people will always feel obligated to get the job done no matter what, she says, and there are some who will take any excuse they possibly can to get out of it. On its website, the U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention acknowledges the problem of fear among hospital workers. Outbreaks can be stressful, and offers some tips for dealing with it, such as deep breaths and exercise. But such tactics amount to band-aid coping mechanisms, said Dr. Jessica Gold, an assistant psychiatry professor at Washington University School of Medicine in St. Louis, who specializes in the mental health of medical workers. Well before the St. Louis area experienced a surge of COVID-19, Gold saw psychological distress in the medical workers she treats. The signs often showed up in their dreams, impending disaster dreams, tidal waves, hurricanes, where a lot of people are dying and you can't help them. Efforts to treat the mental trauma of doctors and nurses amid the pandemic are in their infancy. The first center devoted to this work in the U.S. is due to open on June 15th at New York's Mount Sinai Hospital, but its founder, Dr. Dennis Charney, is not sure how to address the anxiety of medical workers on the front lines of the pandemic, especially when it comes to their risk of infecting their families. I don't know how you prepare for that, he says. One approach would be to copy the military, which often screens soldiers for psychological fitness before sending them into combat. But U.S. hospitals do not have the luxury of screening out healthcare workers during a pandemic. To do that, says Gold, you have to have enough staff to let some people walk away. And staff shortages have been too critical to keep that door open. On April 7th, Rodriguez emailed senior management, ordering them to track down all employees and get them back to work. This is not the time for anyone to walk away from their responsibility and their duty, he wrote. All of you are called to the cause of being a part of something greater than all of us. The soaring language had little effect. For many of the workers who heeded Rodriguez's call, the decision had more to do with paychecks rather than some higher calling. Whatever their chances of getting infected, the prospect of losing their health insurance or being unable to feed their families was worse. Jillian Primiano, an emergency room nurse, captured the sentiment in a sign she held at a demonstration for nurses' rights on September 6th. "Please don't call me a hero," it read. "I am being martyred against my will." 3 days later, the hospital had its first staff death. Terry Small, a carpenter, died of COVID-19 on April 9th. No one knows how he became infected. His job rarely put him in rooms with patients. Venner, his union delegate, also tended to stay in her office, a mask covering the lipstick she always made sure to apply. But as union members came to see her with their complaints, the virus followed. Venner soon became a critical patient in the place where she had worked for almost 30 years. A procession of colleagues came to check on her as Mir attached the breathing machine. Rodriguez went to see Venner one last time on April 16th, 2 days before she died, and came out weeping. "We had our differences," he told me, "but she was my friend." One evening, Rodriguez hung his suit jacket in the executive suite and rode the elevator down to the basement, which houses the morgue. The burden of storing the dead falls to the hospital's transport team, which operates out of a tiny basement office. To show his support, Rodriguez wanted to spend the night with them, collecting the dead and bringing them out to one of the refrigerated trailers the city had parked outside to hold the overflow of bodies. The morgue crew obliged, helping the chief executive into his layers of protective equipment: two masks, a face shield, and a full body suit of polyethylene. Across the hospital, administrators used the same approach, joining staff in the trenches to raise morale. Gallagly Simon, the head of nursing, would leave her spacious office on the second floor to work in the emergency room. The nurses were used to seeing their boss in high heels. Now she was pushing stretchers in rubber clogs, her hair tucked into a cap printed with shamrocks. In the intensive care ward, Mir worked for 6 weeks without a day off, updating health officials and colleagues while also trying to come up with an effective mix of drugs and treatments. Mir's treatment principle was simple at first. Throw everything at it but the kitchen sink. Instead of medical textbooks, he used the blogs of frontline doctors from other continents to guide him. In late March, when President Trump was advocating the use of hydroxychloroquine, an anti-malarial drug, Mir gave it to many COVID-19 patients, then observed it was impairing their heart function. From autopsy reports, he saw tiny blood clots permeating bodies of COVID-19 patients, so Mir ordered patients to get blood thinners. "I call this the disease Russian roulette," he said. One of the first patients he managed to wean off the ventilator was in his 80s. Then he treated two brothers, Miguel and Leobardo Herrera. Leobardo survived, Miguel did not. Mir shook his head. "I don't even make predictions anymore." In mid-April, Mir brought me into the intensive care ward to meet one of his patients, who had spent a week and a half on a ventilator. The tube had been removed from his throat the previous day. As we put on the extra layers of rubber and polyethylene that are required to enter that part of the hospital, a fear came over me. My gut seemed to take the masks, gloves, gowns, and goggles as signs of danger, and I recoiled as though we were about to enter a room full of poisonous gas or radiation. Instead, behind the heavy plastic curtains, there was just a man on a bed, unmasked and barefoot, with more terror in his eyes than I had in mine. He was Christopher Ward, the 29-year-old manager of a Manhattan restaurant and bar. The nurse had just brought him breakfast, and the smell of scrambled eggs mixed with the odor of disinfectants. The tube had strained his vocal cords and left his voice a raspy whisper. The virus, he said, had infected several family members. The last thing he remembered before the anesthesia kicked in was pleading with Mir to get him a ventilator before the nation's stockpile ran out. There were no flowers or greeting cards in his room. None were allowed. To minimize the risk of infection, nurses avoided entering the room except when necessary. Ward did not blame them. "They have good reason to be scared," he says. Once his phone was charged, it began buzzing with messages from his mother, Jacqueline. Forbidden from visiting, she had been keeping vigil at home, texting him passages from Scripture as a comfort to them both. She didn't know how slim her son's chances had been. Only 1 in 5 COVID-19 patients at Wyckoff were making it off the ventilator. Recovery is treacherous for those who survive. Some patients feel better after the tube is removed, texting with family members and talking to their doctors. Then they collapse while trying to stand, their oxygen levels plummeting so fast that they need to be resuscitated. The day after we met, Ward texted me that he was feeling better. 10 minutes later, he wrote again, "I think I'm dying." His mother got a similar message from her son that day, "I may not make it." But 2 weeks later, Ward was ready to go home. The nurses who had cared for them and taken his worried family's calls gathered to see him off, a row of figures in white suits and masks applauding the young man as he made his way to the entrance where his mother was waiting. It was April 20th, and the emergency room was nothing like it had been when Ward arrived. The nurses were afraid to jinx their luck by uttering the words calm and quiet, but for the moment, the hospital was both. The makeshift triage ward in the entryway stood empty. The pharmacy reopened. Amy O'Sullivan, the nurse who had been near death after treating Wyckoff's first COVID-19 patient, had recovered and was back to work, her healthy breaths rising up from her mask to steam her glasses. The lull gave the hospital a chance to consider its future. Regular patients were still afraid to come for treatment or elective surgeries, and fewer patients mean less money. The American Hospital Association, an industry group, calculates that losses for hospitals nationwide will come to more than $200 billion from the beginning of March through the end of June. The federal government gave Wyckoff $59 million in May to help it survive, but Rodriguez says the money will hardly last till the end of the year. "We're living on fumes," he told an all-staff conference call on May 20th. Having finished his rounds, Mir went into his office one afternoon in May, closed the door, and removed his mask. "He had been showing me around for almost a month. Yet this was the first time I had seen his face. It gave me a jolt, like finding a stranger in a familiar room, and it forced my mind to redraw the features it had invented for him. His nose was longer and his mouth wider than I had imagined. In this new company, his eyes seemed sadder than they had above his mask." He told me he had stayed in touch with Rebecca Martin, the Arkansas pulmonologist, sending her updates as her hospital prepared for the pandemic. His news was seldom reassuring. The virus had taken 4 lives among the Wyckoff staff, and their portraits were displayed in the entryway, beneath a sign that read, "Rest in Eternal Peace." Antibody testing of roughly half the hospital's workers found that nearly 22% of them, or 186 people as of early June, had been infected with the virus. Martin realizes how poorly her years of medical training prepared her for the risks she faced at Wyckoff. "In theory," she tells me, "medical school teaches you that your own health and well-being is often secondary to others, but it does not teach you how to decide between treating a highly contagious patient and protecting your family's health." Throughout the outbreak of COVID-19, medical workers have often been held to impossible standards, as though their training brings with it a level of superhuman courage. The reality is far more complicated. For every story of selflessness and sacrifice at Wyckoff, there are stories of medical workers who walked away, usually because they put their family first. At the end of May, Rodriguez announced a $2,500 bonus for employees who had remained on the job through the pandemic. That forced Wyckoff's managers and union leaders to face some tormenting questions. Who made the cut for what some workers called the hero bonus, and who did not? What about the nurse whose husband died of COVID-19, forcing her to miss work and care for their children? What about the workers who got infected and went on sick leave? What about the families of staff who died of this disease? What about those who needed just a few days off to deal with their anguish and fear of infection? Did they not deserve the bonus? In the end, Rodriguez was forced to reverse his decision. Instead, every employee will get a much smaller bonus, whether they worked through the pandemic or not. He says he was tempted at times to apply military logic. If you don't go forward, you're a deserter. But the pandemic is not a war. Bullets and bombs are not contagious. And Wyckoff could not demand that all their employees put their loved ones in the line of fire. If someone is afraid, we respect that they're afraid, Rodriguez says. Mir sees it differently. The truancy of some colleagues pained him, and he has little patience for their arguments that the risks of infection were too high. What does that make the rest of us? He asks, referring to workers who accepted those risks. Chopped liver? His office windows overlook a wide expanse of rooftops, the homes of people Wyckoff serves. Very poor people. Very sick people, he says. Young lives, old lives. Nearly all of them were strangers to Mir, but he did not think it was strange to risk his own life for their care, nor even the lives of his loved ones. He says he would do it again, and as the second wave of the pandemic hangs in the distance, maybe a month from now, maybe more, all of Wyckoff could be called to treat another surge of COVID-19 patients. At least, next time, they will know what to expect from this disease and from themselves. With reporting by Meredith Kohut. I hope that you are finding some of these longer form articles interesting and enlightening that we've been reading over the past few days. That is your coronavirus update for Thursday, August 27th, 2020, from the Recording Library of West Texas. USA Today is coming up next, followed by local news. And here are some of the articles that our volunteers will be reading today. From the Midland Reporter-Telegram, MMH CEO and CDC urge flu vaccinations. Wagner Noel to host drive-in concerts. Laura could bring unsurvivable surge. From the Odessa American, they continued their series this week, Odessa Strong, 1 year later, with the front page article, The Faces Behind the Calls. Dispatchers recall trauma of mass shooting. OC Board discusses tax rate. Council approves ODC 2020-2021 budget. And affidavit details teachers' offense. And of course, at 6 o'clock, we'll bring you the Wall Street Journal. At 7 o'clock this Thursday night, we will bring you our Texas Monthly Archives program. September 1st would have been former Governor Ann Richards' birthday, so we'll be reading some articles that focus on her life. That again is tonight at 7 o'clock on Texas Monthly Archives, and we will be back next on Recording Library of West Texas Radio, USA Today, followed by the Midland Reporter-Telegram and Odessa American at 3.
Now, here's your forecast for the Midland-Odessa area. It's 94 and partly cloudy. Tonight, clear with a low in the low 80s. Then tomorrow, clear with a high around 102. Tomorrow night, clear with a low in the mid 80s. From the Recording Library of West Texas 24-Hour Weather Center, I'm Maria Lopez.
Coronavirus updates, weekdays at 1.
This is the Recording Library of West Texas. It's 2 p.m.
Hello, this is Melanie, and I'm reading articles from the USA Today, Wednesday, August 26th, 2020. Starting with the money section, under the money line column, there are three items today. First one, Exxon and Pfizer are removed from the Dow Jones Industrials. The Dow Jones Industrial Average is replacing three of its components: Dow staple and oil giant ExxonMobil, pharmaceutical company Pfizer, and defense